Hi, good morning, everybody. So today I'm going to talk about some issues in function cosmologies that concerns the curvature and anisotropy. And this talk is based on two papers I wrote with my advisor, Paul Steinhardt. So as physicists, especially cosmologists, we are curious about at least two aspects of the universe. That is, what is the current state of the universe and how did it evolve? Over the past few decades, we have more and more precise measurements, observations of the universe, and we know that the universe today is incredibly homogeneous, flat, and isotropic. And the formation of large-scale structures was seeded by nearly scale invariant perturbations in the early universe. So from a model building point of view, we would like to include these features into our model of the universe. And nowadays, our understanding of the universe has been pretty sophisticated. We know that the universe is expanding today, and if we extrapolate back in time, we know that it must have come out from a hot and dense state, which is called the Big Bang. And there could possibly be an inflationary phase after the Big Bang and before the standard expanding phase. This inflationary phase could potentially give rise to the two conditions that we would like to include in our model. But this doesn't have to be the whole story. And after all, if there has been a past singularity as the beginning of the universe and time, this may not be too aesthetically pleasant. So people have considered alternative scenarios where the Big Bang is merely a transition from some preceding phase into the expanding phase. So in this scenario, the universe goes through a contracting phase followed by a big bounce into the expanding phase. This scenario can date back to as early as Friedman, when he wrote down his equations and considers a closed universe which collapses. He explicitly suggested that the universe could have gone through oscillations of contraction and expansion. But if we want to take the idea of bouncing cosmology seriously, there are several issues that we need to address carefully. So here is the Friedman equation, and I have included a curvature term, and an anisotropic term, and a general term with an equation of state W, which can be taken to be a scalar field phi. And the ellipses may represent matter radiations, which are less important to our discussion here. So to look at these terms individually, the curvature term has an effective equation of state W equal to minus 1/3. And the anisotropy has an effective equation of state W equal to 1. So in a contracting universe, the scale factor A is decreasing. So among these terms, the one that has the largest exponent in the denominator will eventually dominate the density of the universe. And therefore, in order that the universe is not dominated by curvature and anisotropy, we would like to have a component that has an equation of state W greater than 1.
So here's this metric I use.
Oh, just the Friedman.
The F9.
Yeah, because it's a Friedman
equation. So here the K is strictly positive.
Okay. You can choose it to be, yeah. And this scenario is realized by the ecbotic model, where the universe goes through a slow contracting phase with equation of state W much greater than 1. If this phase lasts for extended period, then the homogeneous scalar field will come to dominate the density of the universe and dilutes away the curvature and anisotropy. Meanwhile, it is possible to include some mechanism that gives rise to a scale invariant perturbations. So this ecbotic model was meant to serve as an alternative to inflation that can explain our observation of the universe. And it has many desirable features. However, the question is, can we actually carry these nice properties through the bounce into the expanding phase? people tend to believe that there is no problem with that, and the intuition is that if the bounce happens at very high energy density, then the physics at the bounce should more or less decouple from the low energy physics and does not affect the structure on large scales. And for the specific bounce, there could be two approaches. The first case is a singular bounce where the scale factor actually goes to zero and the energy density inevitably reaches a Planck scale, so we have to have a consistent quantum mechanical treatment of the bounce. Because quantum gravity is not fully understood and it's hard to judge the successfulness in that approach. So alternatively, people consider a simpler scenario, that is, if our intuition is correct that high energy physics decouples, then maybe we can have some effective description of the bounce. Especially, we would like the bounce to be non-singular, that is, the scale factor doesn't go through zero, but instead, the universe slows down contraction and smoothly transitions into expansion. In other words, there is an extended period of h dot greater than zero, which brings the Hubble parameter h from negative to zero. And h equals zero is the bounce. And to see how that happens, we look at the second Friedman equation. And again, I include the similar terms as the curvature and anisotropy. So after the ekpyrotic phase, we can more or less neglect these two terms. And if we simply look at this term and want h dot to become positive, then we see that we need an equation of state w to be less than minus one. And incidentally, if we cross the bound w equals minus one, we are violating the null energy condition that states the rho plus p is semi-positive definite. But people have found the consistent ways to violate the null energy condition without causing catastrophe. For example, one of the few candidates is the gauss condensation model, which I will explain later. So now I have explained what the contraction phase and the bouncing phase may look like, and we need to piece them together. So among the bouncing cosmologies, we can categorize them into four possibilities. And I will not talk about models where the contraction does not include an ekpyrotic phase, because in that case, the contraction is generically unstable to the growth of curvature and anisotropy. I will also not talk much about the singular case because it's complicated. It involves quantum mechanics that I don't want to get involved today. So I will focus on the ekpyrotic and the non-singular case, which is represented by the empty box here.
So what is the ekpyrotic subclass of the bouncing?
It just means that in the contracting phase, there is a period with W much greater than 1. There is an ekpyrotic phase.
So I see that you want, I mean, W much larger than 1 solve the problem.
Yes.
But, any W larger than 6, does it have to be much larger than 1?
Could it be
just
yeah,
two? It's enough. Above 2, is enough. Right?
Yeah. Well, it depends on how, you see, so it has to do with how many number of EFOs you want to dilute away the curvature and anisotropy. If W is very large, then you know you can go for
it's
easier. So the challenge we are facing is how to go through the bounds while maintaining the homogeneity and the scale invariance. And our concern is that once we exit the ekpyrotic phase, and in the bounce, the equation of state has transitioned to less than minus one, what happens to curvature and anisotropy? Do they have time to grow back and cause us trouble? A short answer is yes. So we will see that indeed, we find the huge growth of curvature and anisotropy before the bounce. And this is what I will try to explain in the rest of the talk. So to illustrate these problems, I will consider a specific model of ecbotic non-singular bouncing model, which was proposed by Curie, Avru, and Buchbinder, and this term the new ecbotic model. It is described by an effective Lagrangian of a scalar field phi. Here V of phi is a potential, and also there is a P of function P of x, which is the kinetic term, and we can design these two functions to our needs. And x is the usual kinetic term, which is minus half d phi square. So for a canonical scalar field, P of x is linear in x. Now I will explain these two terms individually. So for the potential, here is a negative exponential part, which is characteristic of an ecbotic phase. So the scalar field, when the scalar field rolls down the potential, it will experience an ecbotic contraction with a very stiff equation of state. Then when it reaches the bottom of the potential, the ecbotic phase ends. And due to inertia, the scalar field will quickly climb up the potential, which is called the kinetic phase. When it reaches certain level up in the potential, we are going to enter the bouncing phase.
So in the kinetic phase, is there an instability kind of tachyonic or ghost-like instability?
Yeah, that's exactly what we are going to consider. So the way to enter the bouncing phase and violate the non-energy condition is to design some specific form of a function P of x. So again, during the ecbotic phase, we want the scalar field to be canonical because the ecbotic mechanism will fit. And the kinetic energy of the scalar field increases exponentially. But to violate the energy condition and induce a bounce from the second Friedman equation, we in fact need a negative slope in the function P of x. That is why we included an exotic feature here at the low energy scale, which is a minimum. And this is called the Gauss condensate model. So as soon as you enter the left side of this critical point, we are violating the now energy condition and eventually lead to a non-singular bounce. So the evolution goes like this, and then after the ecbotic phase, this energy scale comes all the way back to this critical point and induce a non-singular bounce. So I will explain how the ecbotic phase and the non-singular bouncing phase actually come about. So the ecbotic, as I said, the ecbotic phase is this negative exponential part of the potential, and we can parametrize it in this form where P is a parameter. And during the ecbotic phase, the kinetic energy is canonical. So in this case, we have a nice and simple solution to the evolution of the universe, where the scale factor is simply a power law. And here the time t is negative and increases towards zero. So h is 1 over t, and we can see that as t goes to zero, the total energy density increases exponentially. And during this attractor solution, the equation of state is in fact a constant, which is given in terms of the parameter p. If we choose the parameter p to be very small, then we very simply realize this an ecbotic mechanism. Another feature is that during this phase, the kinetic energy scales proportionally with the total energy density and the potential energy. So the duration of the ecbotic phase is given by the number of e-folds, which is measured by the depth of the potential. Because of this proportionality, it can also be expressed in terms of the ratio of the kinetic energy at the end and the beginning of the ecbotic phase.
Do you have like a specific example for this p? It's x plus x squared, or it's because the previous slide the graph looked much.
Oh, you mean p of x?
Yes.
Yes. In the calculations, we do have an explicit example, but in fact, it's not important, as I will show later. We will have a very generic solution to the evolution. So this number of people, this exponential factor, is also the factor by which we by which the curvature and anisotropy are suppressed during the ekphorotic phase. To see this, we simply notice that if p is very small, then the scale factor is almost constant, which means that the curvature and anisotropy or matter radiations, their energy density stays more or less the same, while the total energy density, h squared, is increasing exponentially, which basically means that it's dominated by the scalar field energy that increases exponentially. And this is how the scalar field dilutes away the other components, including curvature and anisotropy. So here I show a simulation of the ekphorotic phase, which is done by numerical relativity codes. This is done by Franz Pretorius and collaborators. I will play it again, but there are several color curves in this video. The yellow curve is what they call matter, is in fact the scalar field. And the pink curve represents the curvature density in the Friedmann equation. And the blue curve is the shear, is the effective density of shear or anisotropy. So the point of this video is to show that although we started with a very generic nonlinear initial conditions where we have a large portion of curvature and anisotropy and a very small portion of the scalar field density, as the ekphorotic phase goes on, this mechanism is very effective to dilute away the curvature and anisotropy, and the universe becomes dominated by regions that are smooth and homogeneous. I can play it again. So you see that quickly the curvature and anisotropy are diluted away, becomes exponentially small, and the universe becomes dominated by a homogeneous scalar field.
So what happens at the boundary?
Yeah, so in fact, they're taking a periodic boundary condition, and the things are just pushed away. It's not like pushed to infinity, but it's just that their volume becomes very small. Exponentially small.
What is the horizontal?
Oh, sorry, the horizontal is spatial, with the spatial dimension. It's
okay.
So then I will explain how the bouncing phase works in this model. And instead of drawing the function p of x, I'm drawing the kinetic energy which enters the first Friedmann equation, h squared. So because of the minimum in p of x, it translates to this strange feature in the kinetic energy t, which is that the t becomes negative when we cross the critical point here. But on the other hand, a negative kinetic energy is essential in our model because remember, at the bounce, the scalar field is up in the potential, so the potential energy is positive. And then, therefore, in order to have h squared to go to zero, we must have a negative kinetic energy to balance out the positive potential energy. But unfortunately, if we are left to this critical point, the speed of sound, which is the ratio of p prime x over t prime x, it becomes negative. This is a signature of instabilities, and that's why we want to have a control over the speed of sound. And if we try to make the speed of sound to be not too big, which translates to a large slope in t of x. This is also nice because in that way we don't need to go too far from the critical point in order to balance out the potential energy. And again, the evolution is that the ekphorotic phase is this linear part, and then the bouncing phase is when it comes back and enters this negative region. So under these simple assumptions, we can actually have a simple solution to the to the equation of motion. And in here, the scale factor goes something like a Cauch, which means it reaches a minimum and bounces back. And correspondingly, the Hubble parameter, it goes like a tench, which starts from negative and increases and crosses zero. So we can, since we have the solution, we can also compute what is the duration of the bouncing phase. It turns out to be to be 1/3 n over hc, and hc is the Hubble parameter around this point. And this is a bit disappointing effect, because people originally imagined that we want to have a quick bounce. In other words, if the bounce happens within a few number of e-folds, then things don't have much time to evolve, and we expect that, you know, nothing will change too much about the perturbations.
So here you have CIS much smaller than 1. How to compare CIS times 30? I mean, is CIS times 30 of older Hubble or much smaller than Hubble still? The sum speed times the time of the bounce.
Well, CS squared is dimensionless.
That's right. I mean, comparing the Hubble time during the bounce.
But Hubble time is dimension 4.
Yes.
You want
CS
squared times delta T VP times HC.
Yeah.
So
actually, my question is N times CS is greater than 1 or smaller than
Yes, that's a very good question. I will come back to it at the very end. So this is actually a way to perhaps avoid the instabilities to grow. Yes.
So just to make a point, because you're saying that the duration of the bounce is of some stuff relevance and R squared or whatever, I think the argument is not valid, because in any case, the bounce itself affects the largest possible scale, which is the background. So why would it not affect all the scales independently of its duration? That's why your intuition to begin with, the decoupling of high energy to low energy, is sort of confusing. I think it's not correct.
Yes, I mean the at the end of our computation, we will show that the intuition, you know, we have to be careful about our intuition.
And I agree that you can show that the bounds, you can realize the bound that does not affect long wavelengths. But I think it's in no way related with its duration. Because whatever the duration, the bounds actually affects the largest possible scale, which is the scale factor, which is the background.
Well, it doesn't have to. For example,
it does, otherwise you wouldn't have bounds.
Well, it depends on how you create the bounce. For example, in the cyclic models originally proposed by Neo and Paul, like they have this extra dimension, they have brains colliding. So the bounce is the collision of the brains, but the dimensions, like the spatial dimension across the brain, like they are not affected by the bounce. So the bounce happens locally in space. Because if you have a singular contraction,
because everything happens at the same time.
No.
That actually means that there is a background.
No.
Are able to define the background.
No.
Affect the bounce.
Yeah, that's a bit confused, because usually the problem arises in UV that the particles, right? Because on large wavelengths, yes, some speed is imaginary. So all I get is more functions are exponential, still oscillatory. So if on those scales I cut the time, they grow, but they don't grow out of control. But the problem is, and when I go to UV, how do I control those ones? And I think in this, so here we are talking about the background, but from what I understood, that the Gauss condensate, then they provoke these higher derivative terms to solve the problem at those scales.
Yeah, I'm saying, I'm pretty happy with that. I mean, you can definitely have a bump that begs exactly what you're saying. That's true. It's just the argument of the duration, which I just put back. And in fact, you can actually also make examples of a bounce which lasts as small a time as you want, and that do affect on at any scale. And my counter argument to that is that it will affect, if instead of seeing it as brains colliding, you just imagine like a closed universe making a bounce, the largest possible scale is, again, which is the background scale, which is a zero modulus total, is affected by the bounce, whatever its duration. That's just what I'm saying.
No, my argument is that this may not be true. In some sense, you know, the bounce can be, you know, the scale factor can go to zero, but on the meantime, things happen locally. Like, it doesn't involve the largest scale.
The bounce.
Yeah. So The reason is that if you think about a singular contraction towards a singularity, then we know the result that things become ultra local towards the end of the bounds. And that is basically means the the metric it becomes a local function, and each point on the space just decouples from each other, and we can consider the local behavior.
I don't know whether local behavior of something which is singular means. I'm sorry, just but that's okay.
So this is trouble because originally we imagine that the bounds can be quick, but it doesn't. But in fact, this is not what the model gives us. And so what this means is that during the bouncing phase, the scale factor actually decreases exponentially. Here n is the number of v-folds, so this is a very small number. And if we remember what we said at the beginning, the Friedman equation, then that means the anisotropy term, which scales as the scale factor to the power of minus 6, this will grow by an exponential number e to the 2n. Now, this number, we remember, is the same factor that the anisotropy has been suppressed during the ekprodic phase. If it has grown by the same number during the ekprodic phase, during the bouncing phase, then that means that it undoes the smoothing that we just did in the ekprodic phase, and whatever amount of anisotropy we have at the beginning, before the ekprodic phase, it will come back to surprise us.
So a bit puzzled. So what really forces these two to be the same?
You mean why the same number of e-folds appears here? Yeah. That's a good question actually, because I want to explain why here the same energy scales at the end of the ekprodic phase and the critical energy at the bouncing phase. Why do they like mix to give you this number? And the reason it appears is that in the end of the ekprodic phase, imagine we're at the high end of the curve. And the transition is that we have to go from this part all the way to the bouncing phase. And because this part is very quick, so during this kinetic phase, the energy, you can think of it as almost conserved. That's why when you start the bouncing phase from here, the energy density of the universe is still on the order of the end of the ekprodic phase. So that is to say, the bouncing phase starts with an energy density that is as high as the end of the ekprodic phase, but then you have to gradually bounce to zero, and that's why these two scales enter.
But in your plot for potential, so you're going from all the way from the bottom of the potential all the way up.
That's right.
But you're saying kinetic energy always balances.
The total energy is conserved. You can see, so the only reason that the energy is not conserved is because of the blue shifting. But if things happen very quickly, then you can think of it as a classical system where the kinetic energy and the potential energy are conserved.
But at that region, you said that the kinetic energy is dominated. So what you're saying is that
not so good term.
Oh, okay, so it isn't.
It has historical origins, why people called it the kinetic phase.
And is it possible to consider a two-field scenario, that one field is kind of irrelevant, another is post-condensate, to get rid of this problem?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And in fact, we have to include such a scenario. And I will show in the next slide. So here our conclusion is that, so this conclusion is purely classical, which is to say that whatever classical anisotropy we have before the ekprodic phase, if we evolve the system, it's going to come back before the bounce. So such a classical result, we imagine we can simulate through numerical relativity codes. And it is being done, and it is still under progress. And I hope this is an advertisement to the results. So yeah, so far what I talked about is on the background evolution level. And in order to see if the model is indeed stable or not, we need to consider its perturbations and see if the perturbations are evolving in a nice and stable way. Especially if we want to take care of the curvature and anisotropy, we would like to have a way that we can perturbably treat the inhomogeneity, the curvature, and anisotropy perturbatively. The way to do this is to start from a linear perturbation about the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric, as usual. And we notice that the functions A, B, psi, and E in the perturbative metric are called the scalar perturbation modes. And we also have a perturbation of the scalar field itself. So that gives us 5 degrees of freedom in total. And these degrees of freedom are constrained by the Einstein equations, which gives us 4 equations. But we know that there is a gauge freedom, and therefore if we fix the gauge condition, then that precisely fixes the evolution of all the degrees of freedom. On the other hand, we want to see what are the physical meanings of these variables. So if we slice the space-time into 3 plus 1, then for a constant time surface, we can compute the geometrical properties. And the intrinsic curvature of this constant time surface is given by the gradient of the variable psi. That is why the variable psi here is referred to as the curvature perturbation. On the other hand, we can also compute the extrinsic curvature of this constant time surface. The traceless part of the extrinsic curvature is the shear tensor. And the shear tensor is directly related to the anisotropy. It is expressed in terms of this function sigma, which is the combination of E prime minus B. And that's why this combination of these two quantities here will be called the shear perturbation. And we are going to, so the way to study the perturbative inhomogeneity curvature and anisotropy is to follow the evolutions of these two perturbations. So I will deal with them separately. And we first look at the curvature perturbations. So from now on, by curvature and shear perturbations, I mean those perturbations that can be generated from quantum fluctuations of the metric and the scalar field during a ecbotic phase. In order to study curvature perturbation, we conventionally use a gauge invariant combination R. And the meaning of this variable R is the curvature perturbation in the co-moving gauge, because in the co-moving gauge where delta phi is 0, it reduces to the variable psi. And through equations of motion, and this variable R obeys this equation of motion, and on large scales, we can neglect, which is a small k, we can neglect the last term here, which gives us 2 general solutions of this equation, and they are given in terms of these 2 terms. I will call these terms the constant term and the integral term respectively. So here I have pulled out a power of square root k here. The 2 general solutions, we have to fix the coefficients in front of the 2 general solutions, and they're done by considering the very early in the ecbotic phase when the modes are deep inside the horizon. We match them into canonical oscillators, and or in other words, we are matching to the Bunch-Davis vacuum, and that fixes these constants. And by putting out a power square root k, these 2 constants will be numerical factors of order 1. So we can analyze this solution. And in the ekphrotic phase, this constant term, well, it's a constant. So it's given by this. It's conserved outside horizon because it's constant. And if we simply count the power of k here, we realize that this gives a blue contribution to the power spectrum. Because for a scale invariant contribution, we want a power k of -3/2. So this one is suppressed by 1 power of k compared to the scale invariant perturbations. And that's why it is suppressed on large scales by exponential factor. It can be expressed in terms of the kinetic energies when the mode exit horizon, which is xk, and the energy kinetic energy scale at the end of the ekphrotic phase. So we defined this number nk to mean the number of e-folds left after the mode exits horizon. As you said, because we realized, as is mentioned by the audience, we realized that this term is blue. So this mechanism itself doesn't give us a scale invariant perturbation, and we have to bear in the back of our mind that we may have some independent mechanism that generates a scale invariant perturbation for us. So on the other hand, if we look at the integral term, then it turns out that at the end of the ekphrotic phase, it can be computed to be this. And if we compare this to the scale invariant perturbation, it is suppressed by 2 powers of k, which means that it's suppressed by e^-2nk. But this is not the end of the story. Life is full of surprises. So if we switch to the kinetic phase, then what happens is that we find the integral term to grow exponentially as w approaches -1. So if we plug in our solution, background solution, to the evolution of perturbation and solve the equation, we get this answer. And compared to the end of the ekphrotic phase, the integral term itself has grown by an exponential factor e^n. And if we compare it to the scale invariant term now, we see that it catches up by this this exponential factor, which basically means that for modes that has nk less than half n, the total curvature perturbation will be dominated by the integral term, which carries a blue spectrum. And this is bad because it contradicts our observations. Well, to
sound speed also play a role. The speed of sound, shouldn't that change the enhancement?
Speed of sound.
That it's going to zero.
It's going to zero at this point. We haven't crossed this critical boundary yet.
Okay, so you're assuming it's 1.
Yes.
Before you start. Running.
Yes. So yeah. So this factor appears, but you see that by the dimensional analysis, this is V over V prime. So it has the dimension 1 over the scalar field phi. And if you don't want such dimension for parameters to exceed the Planck scale too much. And that's why in Planck units, you know, you imagine this.
Dimension phi, not Langevin.
Yes, fine.
So it could be as small.
It could be very small.
It is phi.
So V phi is large. So this is right. But the thing is that so the reason why we choose a very steep potential is that you want to slow down the field, and And generically, you don't expect this thing to be either too small or too large.
They assume that's for their bond, is that the first?
Yeah, we are assuming this to be other one. Let me try to remember why.
But in general, we could have a mechanism that is very.
Yeah. We have considered the one solution, which is to make this thing to be very, to be small. And somehow I don't remember. We can discuss later. So to complete the story, I have to assure you that in the bouncing phase, the curvature perturbation R is again approximately constant. So the change in the bouncing phase is negligible. That's why. If this blue spectrum is generated, it will be carried into the expanding phase, and that is not acceptable compared to the observations. So that's one problem we have found. And now I will come to the business of the anisotropy. So we will analyze it in a similar fashion, that is, we compute the evolution of the shear perturbations. We again can make up a gauge invariant combination, which is written here. It is called, we denote it by sigma c, and it represents the scalar shear perturbation in a co-moving gauge. Now, from equation of motion, this quantity can be related to the co-moving curvature perturbation through this expression. And as we have seen, the co-moving curvature perturbation itself grows by an exponential factor. So it is natural to expect that this combination actually inherits the same exponential growth during the kinetic phase, which is indeed the case, as can be verified by computation. Now, this raises a serious problem, because this is even before we start the bouncing phase. And if such exponential factors appear, then we might worry, does perturbation theory already break down at this point? Or does the universe already become anisotropically dominated at this point? So if that's the case, can we actually go beyond this point? And the answer is yes, and we only need to change a gauge, which means that perturbations, I mean that perturbation theory is well-defined, works, as long as you can find one gauge where the variables remain perturbative. And you can think about other quantities as formal definitions in terms of the variables in this gauge. So a convenient gauge is the uniform Hubble gauge, which is defined by the fact that on the constant time surfaces, the variation in the Hubble expansion is zero. In other words, this gauge is a very natural and a convenient gauge to study the bounds, because in this gauge, the bounds will be simultaneous. And the advantage of this gauge comes with a bonus, which is that the shear perturbation in this gauge is proportional to the co-moving shear perturbation through this factor. And exactly at the point where h dot is zero, we see that our problem is suppressed. So this means that in this gauge, we can safely pass through this bounce. However, we should not be too optimistic, because once h dot has crossed this zero point and becomes positive again, then on large scales, this k squared term is small. So you see that the shear perturbation will grow to the same size as what we have seen in the bouncing phase. So the problem is only delayed. We have delayed the problem past this critical point, but it will eventually come back before the actual bounce.
So what happens when the denominator vanishes there?
Well, you mean when h dot becomes So at the point where this thing vanishes, then this gauge is not well defined.
Is that right? You think that's just a gauge artifact for that matter?
Yeah. So if if this shear perturbation comes back before the bounce, we want to ask how much anisotropy does it give us, and whether this magnitude of anisotropy caused trouble to us. In order to see the to estimate the magnitude of anisotropy, we recall the relation of the shear tensor to the variable sigma. And to estimate the size, so we have to integrate over the Fourier modes, which is the integration written here. If we plug in our result for sigma and integrate, we will find this result. We see that h at n is the energy density at the end of the ecbotic phase. But then we have two extra factors in the front. So this factor is the ratio of scale factor to the sixth power. And we may still remember that this is the same factor that we see gives the growth to the classical anisotropy. So this will give us a power e to the 2n. On the other hand, we have an extra factor, which is the ratio of the energy energy scale at the end of the ecbotic phase and the critical and the energy density at the Gauss condensate point. So this factor is similar to what we saw in the curvature perturbation case. And because we have a square here, that is why it doesn't come with the square root. And this factor gives us an extra e to the 2n. That's why altogether it gives us e to the 4n. This is a huge exponential factor, and this combination, this whole total result, can easily be much greater than the energy density at the end of the ecbotic phase. So in other words, we should expect that before the bounce, the anisotropy will overwhelm the total density of the universe. So if we recall that the way we want the scalar field to dilute away anisotropy and to bring the universe to a smooth transition is to have the scalar field dominate over anisotropy and the curvature. But if here, instead of the scalar field, the anisotropy dominates, and which makes the scalar field negligible, then there is no way we can expect the scalar field to still do the job for us. And that is why, if this happens, then then our design of the non-singular bounce will be disrupted totally. So I will summarize. So also through this talk, I have mentioned four problems that we see in this kind of framework of combining an ecbotic phase with a non-singular bounce. And the first problem we saw is the negative speed of sound, which usually which signifies an instability. And as was mentioned, a simple solution is that if this is the duration of the instability, so this is the factor that appears in the exponential. If this thing is less than 1, then the instability will not grow too much. Now, we already see that the duration of the bounce cannot be tuned too small, because it's already given by the background evolution. But we still have the freedom to tune CS itself. So you know, you can imagine ways to get around this by you know, fine-tuning the function p of x so that the CS itself is exponentially smaller, and then we can still satisfy this condition. The second problem we saw is the classical anisotropy, which is purely given by this simple scaling rule, a to the 6. And as a result, we find a growth of e to the 2n. And so as I said, this means whatever anisotropy you have before the ecbotic phase, it becomes suppressed during the ecbotic phase, but then gets amplified again through the bouncing phase. Now, of course, we can also imagine solutions to this problem, which is that if, even before the ecbotic phase, we already start with a very negligible anisotropy, then even if it comes back, it is still under control. And this solution is also is possible, for example, in the setting of cyclic models, in which before the ekpyrotic phase, you will generically have a dark energy phase, and the dark energy phase will, you know, will dilute away the anisotropy and the curvature to a certain extent. Now, the next two problems are more severe because they are of a quantum origin. They are generated by quantum fluctuations in the ekpyrotic phase when the modes are still deep inside horizon. So these two problems cannot be removed by fine-tuning the initial conditions at the beginning of the ekpyrotic phase. And so we have seen that for the curvature perturbation part, we find a huge growth of the adiabatic modes, which carries a blue spectrum. And for the shear perturbation part, we see that the effective density of shear perturbation has grown by a huge factor e to the 4n, which will totally take over the total the energy density of the universe and take over the bounds. So by the classical results of Wheeler and BKL, we know that if the anisotropy is dominant and during a bounce, then the bounce will be chaotic, and we will, and this is called the mixed master behavior, where the universe expands in a certain direction while contracting in the other, and then they randomly switch conditions, and things become chaotic and very singular and inhomogeneous. So,
how big is it then?
Sorry?
How big is n? You have capital n.
N, yeah. So for inflation, n is 60. But in terms of the cyclic models,
but this is n total in the ekpyrotic.
Yeah, n is the epochs of the ekpyrotic phase. So in the contracting ekpyrotic cases, n is usually taken to be 120.
And nk.
Nk is the number of epochs. So there. Yeah. So one mode exits horizon during this n epoch. So nk is the, you know, the epochs after it exits horizon. So it varies from 0 to n.
So for a smallest node, it's a smaller paper for a smallest node.
For small modes, it exits horizon early, which means that nk is large. So you have more epochs to go before the end of it.
But you can make n much more than 120.
You can have n plus 10. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so people have thought about, so there are alternative views of contracting models where people don't try to solve the horizon problem. But basically, they only generate a scale invariant perturbation that is observed astrophysically. And in that way, you can push n to be as little as on the order of 10. But this doesn't solve the horizon
problem. There's no horizon problem.
You need 60.
So n here is the number of epochs of AH, foundation AH.
That's right, yes. So facing these two problems, we, in order to avoid them or like overcome these problems.
Actually, even with 60, I don't agree. Because you don't have to reheat like temperature. You reheat much lower. Maximum temperature
is like 35. Okay. So let's try to understand what is causing the problem, and once we have a better grasp of the core of the problem, we may be able to progress further. And so I show a plot of P of X here, and all trouble comes from our effort to merge the ekpyrotic phase with the non-singular bouncing phase. And where that comes from is that normally when people design an ekpyrotic phase, we have a canonical scalar field. So there is a linear part of the kinetic term. And during the ekpyrotic phase, the kinetic energy increases exponentially. On the other hand, we want this negative slope in the bouncing phase. And for the reason of stabilities, we don't want the negative slope to be a maximum over there, because then there will be a real ghost over there. So in a consistent way of violating the null energy condition, which is the Gauss condensate model, you have to put it as a minimum. And therefore, if the minimum is here, then of course when you want to enter the bouncing phase, you have to come back to this low energy region. In other words, the energy scales have to satisfy these hierarchical relations. So I have said that the behavior, the rounding of the energy scales is that during a product phase you increase exponentially, but then you have to come back all the way to enter the null energy condition violating phase to trigger the bounce. And this coming back is exactly how this low energy scale is linked to this high energy scale. And once this link happens, large ratios, large factors like this will naturally emerge in various aspects. And we have illustrated, I have showed examples of how this factor appears in certain places to cause troubles. So I have to, So I want to address that there is some intuition about this decoupling that I mentioned at the beginning. This failure here doesn't quite contradict our intuition because by design, when people propose Gauss condensate, it is meant as a low energy effective theory. So when people try to adopt this Gauss condensate model in cosmology to induce the bounce, we should already be cautious, because once you include a low energy mechanism in your model, you should naturally worry if it affects large scale structures. And our example showed you that this indeed happens, and so the mix of the energy scales will cause problems. So that brings us, so that will suggest a few ways to go around these problems. For example, I haven't discussed the singular bounce, because the four problems we stated in today's talk, none of them appears in the singular bounce. That is natural, because by definition, the singular bounce, the scale factor goes to zero, so the energy density keeps on increasing, and you're always going towards higher energies, and that's why the low energy effects never appears to bother us. On the other hand, there may be hope that we can give up the conventional realization of the ecbotic phase with a canonical scalar field, but we may design some nonlinear form of P of X to realize the ecbotic phase. If X only varies in a limited region, a limited range, so it doesn't have to go far away and then come all the way back, then maybe these problems will be much more mild. On the other hand, there is another interesting aspect that I've been thinking about, which is to put aside the story about the scalar field, but take a more phenomenological approach. That is, we can try to directly deal with an effective theory for the curvature perturbation R itself, and the Lagrangian for R will be given in terms of the equation of state epsilon and the speed of sound CS. So in fact, such a theory will be in one-to-one correspondence with a scalar field, and that's why we can just put the scalar field in the back of our mind and directly deal with the curvature perturbation. And the progress of the work is that, so we are able to translate the problems we find in terms of the epsilon and CS square, like what happens to the evolution of these two variables, and then we have a better control. So we can start building more successful models directly in terms of epsilon and CS square. But this is still under progress. Thank you. happy to take questions.
So one thing that seems like, I haven't really played around with it, but I mean, what it seems like a big restriction to, instead of taking a general function of e of x and phi, to take b of x plus b of phi.
Mm-hmm.
Well, is that another route to relaxing? Is that, first of all, why did people just make that for algebraic convenience, or is there some physical reason to do that?
Yes. So, yeah, that is actually very closely related to this phenomenological approach. So the reason, is there chalk?
That's a very interesting.
That's on the table.
In the box.
In the box.
Oh,
in the box.
Thanks. So it's true that if you design some Lagrangian, which is a general function of x and phi, then we have more freedom to design the model. But then on the other hand, it's interesting. So on the other hand, the trouble with this is that think about the actual cosmological evolution of this Lagrangian. Then you have only one history of the universe, right? So you are only exploring one trajectory in this two-dimensional manifold. So you think about this as a multivariable function, p, so it's a function defined on a surface, but the actual evolution of the universe is only one trajectory, is only a one-dimensional curve on this surface. And that's why you're not really exploring the whole landscape of this function. In a more mundane way to say this is that if you have this kind of separable form, then you only have two scalar degrees of freedom to tune, and this actually is in one-to-one correspondence with these two variables epsilon and c s squared. So you have these two degrees of freedom on the phenomenological side, and on the other hand, it corresponds precisely to these two degrees of freedom that you can play with the Lagrangian. So this is why this phenomenological approach is a bit attractive, because we have this confidence that if we find a successful evolution of these two variables, we can always back engineer to find underlying scalar Lagrangian for the scalar. But on the other hand, this is not true for this general case.
Because the generic case we discussed the generic case in that we did the K bounds some years ago, and that's exactly what you're saying. Just whatever function you can always expand anywhere close to the bounds. So we have very general conditions for the bounds to happen using whatever not necessarily symmetric function.
Yeah. So they can, you can also imagine cases like there is a function of phi times function p of x. This is also a possible way.
Or anything else.
Yeah, but the point is that you only have two scalar functions instead of a multivariable.
So I didn't understand why you couldn't take
the
Ternary p of x at the top instead of going down at the bottom.
Yes. So it has to do with the existence of ghosts in the model. So purely from a field theory point of view, then if you have some Lagrangian like this, and you want to consider the excitations around this point, so what people do, the analysis people do is that you expand the scalar field around this point, and so this will be some constant. Some background plus perturbations, which can be called as new field pi, and you want to find you want to reduce the Lagrangian to a Lagrangian for the excitations pi, but then you will find that so if it is a minimum, so basically you want to find the coefficient of the quadratic term of the excitation pi, and it turns out that the quadratic term of the pi dot square is given by t of x, or in other words, it's 2x p of x minus p. Oh, sorry.
So, sorry.
This is wrong.
Sound is between less than 1, doesn't that just give you the...
So in other words, T of X is given by plus B. Can you?
You shouldn't go very far.
okay. So T of X is equal to T of X. So for this field, to not be a scalar, not to be a ghost, you want this thing to be positive. And this thing is given in terms of this. So you see that if it is a minimum, then you know at a minimum this term vanishes by definition, and you want this to be positive. But if it's a maximum, then this is negative, and you will have ghosts around this point. But in fact, we are also thinking about scenarios about turning over here, because it naturally avoids problems. But this analysis is only a perturbative analysis here. So it's true that if you stay here, there could be some ghost excitations, but if you just go past here and roll down, non-linearly, you may be able to go around the problem.
I have a related question that if you generalize the model a little bit, say from a generalized kinetic term here to say Hadamardian scenario,
yeah,
there is no ghost. Is it possible?
Yes, that's right. So ghost condensation is one of the maybe only two known examples to violate the null energy condition consistently. The other example is the Galileans. And in fact, there was a recent paper like a few months ago called G-bounce. People tried to use Galilean fields to generate a non-singular bounce. I haven't really looked into
it. And I have another question. So you were considering the scalar part of the perturbation. Mm-hmm. What about the vector part of the perturbation?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Actually, so the first thing to notice is that because in our model, we only have a scalar field as the source. So intrinsically, there will be vector perturbations of the metric, but it is not sourced by the scalar field. So it evolves independently, and its evolution follows very simple power laws. And in fact, you will see that the vector part of this shear perturbation evolves simply like this. Which means that this is proportional to this, and what that means is that the sigma square, the contribution to the anisotropy, scales exactly as a to the minus 6. So this is another way to show you that the shear perturbation corresponds to the anisotropy in the Friedman equation.
But
it
depends on
what. Tensor modes. Tensor modes. Let me see. Yeah, I forgot.
The long wavelength ones are the same.
Yeah. That's what I would expect. But
for H dot. H double dot plus. Is that dot property?
This?
Yeah.
So
then
it would
be the same equation
for
H dot.
That's
the long
wavelength. For the tensor, sorry, what do you mean like this dot?
H double dot plus 3H.
You mean replace this by?
No, sorry. Too many H's. I mean HIJ.
Yes. No, you're saying this, right?
Yeah. No, not just 3A over 3. It's the same.
Yeah. That's right, actually. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so H will be Yeah, there will be a constant term and there will be an integral term.
Another question is the long, at some stage in your table, you said that you solved the CS, KCS time delta t problem by saying that it's small. And you said, okay, for your solution here for the gravitational instability is fine. That's the solution is defined for long wavelength. It's short wavelength. Do you expect large number of black holes formation for these sort of things on very small scales?
Well, first of all, and there is a cutoff on the scales, right? We only care about the modes that exit horizon during the ecbotic phase. We only care about the modes that re-enter the horizon.
Well, the other one is, and they are there as well.
And yes,
they are
there, but if they're outside horizon, then they're outside our horizon, then we don't really know if they could collapse.
I think it's outside the horizon.
Oh, you mean at the bounds? You mean at the bounds?
The very small scale, what I mean. The very small scale that K is such to be large.
Sorry, you mean large K.
Is not satisfied.
For large K modes, for large K modes, I think we only care about if the mode is. Is inside horizon, and then I think we expect it to be oscillating.
I think you need to invoke those higher derivatives for
your
example.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure, but I would
I mean, yeah, that's why you need those fundamental.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying that I suppose the gravitational collapse will take place and you'll form a large number of very small black holes. Now, maybe these small black holes are so small that they will evaporate almost instantaneously.
I think what she said is correct. So for a large case, there will be the dispersion relation of the Gauss condensate model. You have some minus k square on the first order, so there will be like cs square. But then for large case, you expect the fourth order terms that turns things back.
Before we thank our speaker again, I just remind you that we're back here at 1 for another presentation.